local guy, sees after the place twice a month, has a key. I left him a message, haven't heard back. But I don't need him. Felice said she'd leave one under the mat.
New friend.
Common enemy.
I began walking out.
Where are you going?
Shave, shower, etc.
Getting yourself dapper?
He said.
Good. I have my standards.
Chapter 25. A manila envelope leaned against the door of the Corbin house. Trevor Bitt's pickup was parked next door. Milo studied the cactus tutor, scratched the side of his nose, and contemplated, then returned to the unmarked he'd picked up this morning. A smooth-driving, slate-blue Dodge Charger that still smelled of new car. Way above his usual ride. Hope leads you to all sorts of self-affirming places. Once behind the wheel, he uncoiled a string on the flap of the envelope. Inside was a key chained to a fob and a folded piece of white paper. The fob was a plastic Disneyland souvenir, Snow White, chaste and unaware she was despised. The paper listed computer-typed directions to the Arrowhead house, the alarm code, and the number of Dave Brassing, the occasional caretaker. Programming the car's GPS, Milo checked it against Felice Corvin's directions.
Perfect.
Big V8, muscular and smooth.
I said, how'd you score the Hot Wheels? Got A's on my homework and begged Daddy for the keys.
Big grin.
Found out a mere sergeant in burglary was planning to use it tomorrow and pulled rank.
What's next? An Oscars after party?
Actually, I could have gone to one last year. One of Rick's patients is the bimbo girlfriend of a noted producer. Drove into a pole while taking a selfie. Rick put her arm and shoulder together. Well enough to service Daddy Filmbucks because he extended the invite.
Why didn't you go?
More allergies. Both of us.
To what?
Ego cancer and bullshit.
The route from the Palisades to the Inland Empire's resort areas was the 405 North, the 134 East, merged to the 210, State Route 18 up to the mountains. Decades ago, European road architects figured out that curves keep drivers awake, hence the Autostrada, the Autobahn, and the like. Not so Caltrans. The result is thousands of miles of hypnotic straightaway that scalpel through marginalized neighborhoods. It's a nonstop display of trailer parks, houses that might as well be trailers, discount malls, car lots the size of small towns, big box retailers with the grace of an unshielded sneeze. Intersections in freeway districts are built around gas stations, grease pits, and fast food joints. The less fortunate citizens of California contend with toxic air, brain-scraping noise, and opportunistic criminals hopping off the freeway to felonize before on-ramping back in celebration. When I'm not behind the wheel, I find it hard to stay awake on the freeway, and I dozed off halfway through the 90-mile drive. I woke up on the outskirts of San Bernardino and checked my watch. What should have been a 90-minute drive had stretched to 2 hours and 13 minutes.
Accident?
Milo's jacket had taken on wrinkles. His hair spiked where he'd rubbed his scalp.
Couple of semis tangoed 20 miles back. Ambulance injuries. Cleared by the time we got there, but that didn't stop idiots from gawking. Now it's even worse with the cell phone photos. Explain that to me. What's the thrill?
I said, new age slapstick, enjoying the fact that the other guy slipped on a banana peel.
Cruel world, he said. Lucky for me.
A mile later,
you were snoozing away, amigo. How the hell do you sleep like that?
I rarely do, but how would he know?
Clear conscience.
Damn, he said, slapping his forehead.
Too late for that.
The outskirts of San Bernardino were what you'd expect, made dreary by Beijing-level smog. The airborne dirt vanished a few miles into Highway 18, the state route's primary access to the San Bernardino Mountains. Four lanes that shift gradually to a gear-challenging climb and top-of-the-world views. 18 snakes up to a series of ski resorts before sloping east and descending to the Mojave Desert. The final stop is Adelanto, a town founded over a century ago as a citrus-growing community, switching to poultry farming when that didn't work out, continuing to struggle as the economic allure of two private prisons proved illusory. I'd been there a few years ago, evaluating the custodial fitness of a father imprisoned for a massive insurance scam and about to be released, the kind of guy who could easily fool a polygraph. My report was thin on details, but loaded with implication. The judge got the point. Today's trip included only the first 20 or so miles of 18 as we entered Arrowhead Village. Along the way, signs proclaiming gated guarded communities and admonishing trespassers had alternated with flecks of lake view that pierced the tree canopy randomly, loose sapphires in a green velvet box. On the water side of the commercial center's cottagey shops and restaurants, the forest had been cleared, exposing an expanse of blue peppered by white boats. The lake itself is pure Southern California, theatrically gorgeous but artificial. Created as a reservoir, left unfinished after being ruled illegal and subject to decades of shifting ownership, fraudulent land transfers, and inside deals, it had finally settled as a weekend escape, where dockside mansions served as stopovers for movie stars and tycoons. We continued west, turned onto Brewer Road, and entered a tract of modest residences widely spaced on generous lots. Weekend places for the financially comfortable. The attraction here was the much smaller Grass Valley Lake, and a golf course. No gates, no warnings. Our destination, marked by a rustic address sign on a tilting stake, was curtained by white pines, black oaks, and ponderosas, and visible only as a smear of cedar siding. Milo said, "Just Molly and me in our brown heaven," and hooked onto a long dirt driveway bordered by rocks the size of Galapagos tortoise shells. The house finally came into view seconds later, shoved off-center by a clutch of monumental firs. One-story A-frame, cedar planks oiled long ago and graying at the edges. No garage, no fencing. Two large plastic garbage cans stood to the left. We got out of the car, greeted by chittering birds and rustling leaves. Milo checked the cans. Empty. His eyes shifted to the ground nearby. Three mousetraps, one hosting a rodent skeleton. Close by was a rogue patch of grass, defying its host patch of gravel. Ruts and tracks ran through the blades and continued to the gravel. Wildlife partying. Most likely squirrels, chipmunks, and raccoons. The trash can lids were held in place by metal clasps. Claw marks scored the tops. Coons or bears, juveniles lacking the skill and attention span to pull off a prolonged assault. Milo returned to the Dodge, now dusted with pollen, popped the trunk, and removed his attaché case. Out came two sets of booties and gloves. I said, "Expecting a crime scene?"
"Expecting anything."
We covered our shoes and hands, and I followed him to the front door. Big, lumbering shape in coarse brown. Adult bear, ready to forage. The alarm panel just inside the door whined. Milo punched buttons from the code he'd memorized, created silence, took in the layout. A single high-peaked space was sectioned by furniture and appliances into a living room with a doorway to the left, a dining area, and a kitchen separated from a laundry room by a waist-high partition. Open-beamed ceiling. Cheap blue felt carpeted the entire floor. The rear wall was glass, a triangle composed of several window frames and interrupted by a rear door. Outside was a skimpy lawn, then a mass of black-green, the rear boundary unclear. A glass-shaded chandelier, unreasonable facsimile of Tiffany, dangled from a center beam. The furniture was bolted together, blonde wood and plastic, contrasting with dark-stained wood walls and ceiling. Every upholstered surface was brown. If Milo sat down, he might disappear. Still in the doorway, he called out,
"Police! Anyone home?"
Nothing. Placing his hand on his Glock, but leaving it holstered, he motioned me to wait and entered. A minute later, he was back.
"All clear."
He picked up his case, sniffed, nostrils flaring. I said, "Exactly." Empty house, but the air lacked the dirty socks must of disuse. Instead, a pleasant scent washed through, aromatic, familiar. Armani. I pointed to a brown princess phone on the floor next to a couch. 80s vintage, the closest thing to an antique. He took an evidence bag out of his case, uncoupled the phone from its cord, bagged it.
"If there are prints anywhere, they'll be here. Not that we don't know who was answering Chet's calls. This clinches it. Again, you're right. Girlfriend, not a pro in that motel room."
I said nothing. He said,
"Stop bragging. Look what happened to Chet."
He walked around, opening and shutting drawers and cabinets. Cheap crockery, glassware, utensils, pots and pans. Stepping around the partition to the laundry room, he took his time with the washer-dryer. Empty, spotless, dry. Same for a plastic utility sink and a cheap wicker hamper. Utility storage consisted of detergent, bug spray, a coiled garden hose, a toolbox whose stiff latch said it hadn't been open for a while, 4 mousetraps in heat-sealed plastic packets. We returned to the living room, continued through the left-hand doorway. 2 identical 9x9 bedrooms were dimmed by pebbled windows set high in a tongue-and-groove wall and separated by a Jack and Jill bathroom. Nothing in the medicine cabinet. The master bedroom at the end of the hall was larger, but far from generous. The smell of perfume was stronger. Clear glass windows provided the same green view as the living room triangle. The lav was en suite, but drab. No sheets, pillows, or cases on the queen bed. 1 dresser, also unused. No clothes in the closet, but lots of neatly folded percale and terry cloth. I said, "Rarely used until now," and she cleaned up compulsively. Same as the motel. Same as Braun. He stared.
"She's more than a love interest?"
"Just throwing out ideas." Noise from the front of the house whipsawed both our heads. A door closing. Footsteps. Milo unsnapped his gun and pulled it out, sidled toward the doorway. He tensed for a second, slipped through, pointed the Glock.
"Freeze!"
A male voice said,
"Oh, Jesus, God!"
The man's hands were up, and they trembled. So did his legs.
"Please, man!"
High-pitched nasal voice.
"Take what you want and..."
Milo said,
"Police, continue to cooperate."
Extricating his badge, he flashed it. The man said,
"Jesus, Mary, Mother of God!"
A meaty face that had gone pale began to take on color, achieved ruddiness within seconds. His posture loosened, but he continued to shake.
"Can I?"
he said, waving his fingers.
"Got a sore rotator cuff."
Milo said,
"Name?" "Dave Brassing."
"The caretaker?"
"That's me, sir. I promise there's ID in my pocket."
"Okay, at ease. Didn't mean to startle you, but I called and you never answered, so I wasn't expecting you."
"Sorry, sir. I was going to."
Brassing waited until the Glock was reholstered before letting out a wheezy sigh and flopping his arms to his sides. Late 40s to early 50s, stocky, he had a broad face bristled by bushy sideburns and bottomed by 8 inches of graying, spade-shaped goatee. A battered, broad-brimmed leather hat sat askew. A gray work shirt was splotched with fear sweat. Baggy cargo shorts revealed calloused knees. The soles of hiking boots were crusted with leaves.
"Oh, man," he said, placing a hand over his heart. "You scared the stuffing out of me."
His cheeks fluttered as his head moved to the side. Milo said,
"So, Dave, what brings you here?"
"Checking around," said Brassing. "For you, actually. I was going to call after I saw that everything was okay."
Not getting the point of evidence preservation, Brassing said,
"Phew!"
His chest heaved.
"You want some water, Dave?"
"No, I'm okay. Can I sit down?"
"Sure. Didn't mean to freak you out, Dave."
"My fault. Should have answered you sooner," said Brassing. "I saw your car, figured it was police, but when you rushed out with that heater..."
He exhaled, face glassy with sweat.
"Guns are a thing with me. I used to hunt. Nothing bothered me. Then I got held up a few years ago, and when I see him, I get kind of queasy."
"Sorry about that."
"Yeah," said Dave Brassing. "Armed robbery. It was hairy."
Milo said,
"It happened around here?"
"Down in San Bernardino. I was working at a tire store. A couple of hoodies came in and shoved iron in my face and had me clean out the register. I thought I was going to... Thank God there was some cash in there."
I said, "What a thing to go through."
"Wouldn't wish it on my enemy," said Brassing. "I'm not saying I got rid of my weapons. Fact is, I'd have been better off packing when they showed up. But I look at guns different now. The one they used was a .38 Smith W. One of mine was one of those. I got rid of it."
He bit his lip.
"I don't even want to watch movies with shooting. Anyway, I should have called out, 'Hello, it's Dave,' or something. I didn't figure. Phew. Oh, okay, I'm breathing again."
Milo said,
"You sure you're okay? Don't want water?"
"I'm fine, thanks. No worries. Actually, yeah. Water sounds good. Mind if I get it myself?"
"Go for it, Dave."
Brassing walked to the kitchen, filled a glass from the sink, held it up to window light.
"It was good last time I checked, but winter there was runoff silt. Nothing dangerous, just minerals, but it tasted bad."
He chugged the entire glass, filled another, repeated.
"Took me a while to convince them to fix it. Finally did. Deposits in the tank. Not a small job."
I said, "They don't use the house. Don't want to put out the money."
"You got it."
"How long have you been taking care of the place?" Brassing put down the empty glass and sat back down.
"I don't really take care, like a big detailed deal. What it is, I come in once a month, except winter, when it's 2-3 times. Got to make sure the pipes don't freeze, all that good stuff."
He pointed to the rear window.
"Also that, in the winter. That much glass, you get constriction of the frames, the glue dries, you get leaks."
I said, "Then there's the mousetraps."
"Oh, yeah, that too. Little buggers used to get inside, poop all over the place. That was gross. I sealed off holes and cracks, baited outside to keep them away from inside."
Tensing.
"You're not saying you saw some in here?"
"Just traps near the garbage cans."
"That's okay," said Brassing. "I also got them placed clear back to the end of the property."
"Where is that, Dave?"
"Right where the grass ends."
"Not the trees," I said.
"That's the neighbor, super rich guy, computers or something. He's got 15 acres at least, big stone house. Not that he uses it either. That's the way it is here. They say it's an investment. He said that, Mr. Corvin. He wasn't a bad type. Still can't believe what happened to him."
"Mrs. Corvin told you."
"On her message. That was kind of... But I'm not judging."
I said, "Unemotional?"
"Yeah," said Brassing. Hi, Dave. Need to let you know. Then she lays that on me. Like, please check the garbage cans. And, oh, yeah, Chet got killed.
Is that her usual approach?
Couldn't tell you. Maybe I seen her 3 times. I always dealt with him.
Could we hear the message? Looking puzzled, Brassing produced his phone, scrolled, activated. Felice Corvin's voice came on, cool, soft, articulate.
David Brassing, this is Mrs. Corvin. Not sure of your schedule, but I'm calling to let you know the police will be examining the house in the near future. Mr. Corvin was shot and killed.
Click.
Dave Brassing said, Wow, that's colder than I remembered.
Milo said, You've met her 3 times.
Maybe, could be 2.
What about the kids?
Brassing shook his head.
They said they had kids, but never seen any.
And Mr. Corvin?
More, said Brassing, but not a lot. They bought the place something like 2.5, 3 years ago. I worked for the people before them, the Liebers. That was real caretaking. They were older folk, retired. They used it all the time. Were still skiing when they were like 80. They recommended me to the Corvins.
I said, How many contacts have you had with Mr. Corvin?
Oh, I'd say 8, 9. Mostly on the phone. Don't know, really.
Milo said, In 3 years.
Yep. It's mostly copacetic here.
How about this year?
Twice? 3? Last time was like 1 month ago? The mice. I guess he was here and saw droppings. He called me up, said, What do I pay you for?
Copping an attitude.
Well, said Brassing, can't say I blame him. Who wants to see that? I finally figured out there was a small hole in the lint trap vent. Sealed it off, no more little Mickeys.
He smiled. Lots of missing teeth, and the dentition that remained was yellow and ragged.
Problem solved, I said. Was he grateful? He never complained.
Removing his hat, he scratched dense gray hair.
Milo said, When Mr. Corvin stayed here, who was he with?
Who? Said Brassing. I'm assuming her.
Mrs. Corvin.
Brassing's bushy eyebrows flickered.
You're saying not?
Not saying anything, Dave. When's the last time the master bedroom got used?
Said Brassing. Not for a while. I haven't been here in 1 month, but even before that, it's not like it was regular.
How could you tell?
They always cleaned up real good, said Brassing. New sheets, new pillowcase.
I said, There's perfume in the air. Smell it? Brassing sniffed.
Can't smell so good. Yeah, I'm catching a whiff.
Familiar?
No, not really.
Deviated septum? Said Milo.
Brassing tapped his right nostril.
Tumor. Back when I was in high school. Played football, got a monster headache. Everyone figured it was a hard tackle, but it was a tumor. Benign, they rooted around and got rid of it. I had headaches for years, but now it's okay. But not much sense of smell. Some of my taste, too. My wife says, it don't matter anyway. I'm no gourmet.
Gap-toothed smile.
Guess I'm the lucky one.
Milo and I looked at him.
The tumor, then getting held up and surviving, said Brassing. A few other things in between. God pulled me through.
I admire your faith, Dave, said Milo.
My pastor says it's easy to have faith when things work out good. The key is when it's rough. Think I'll get myself more water.
He drank a third glass, came back.
Milo said, So you have no idea who Mr. Corvin stayed with?
I'm getting a feeling it wasn't the wife, huh? You're thinking that's what got him killed?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Dave. We're just asking questions.
Got it. Wish I had answers for you.
No idea who might have stayed here with Mr. Corvin?
Sorry, nope.
What about something left in the garbage? A credit slip, anything with ID?
No garbage, said Brassing.
What do you mean?
The cans were always empty. I guess they could have taken it to the dump. It's at Heaps Park, a few miles down the mountain on the way back to the freeway.
They don't pay for trash collection?
They do, said Brassing. When I throw stuff out, mouse traps, whatever, it gets picked up. He tugged at his beard. $50 a month doesn't sound like much, but I like to come up here anyway. Breathe some good air.
Come up from where?
San Bernardino. I'm semi-retired. Do flea markets on the weekend. Used to do other houses, but now it's just this and another one closer to the village.
When Mr. Corvin was here, which car did he drive?
The first time I met him, he had a Jaguar, the big sedan. The only other times, maybe one, maybe two, he had a Range Rover.
Brassing slapped his forehead.
Shoot, I forgot. Sorry. A week ago, after I checked my other house, the Palmer's, I decided to drive by, just an overall look, nothing huge I needed to deal with, and this car drove toward me the opposite way, seemed to be coming from the property. I can't be sure, but the houses are pretty far apart. It seemed to be coming from here. It was already up the road by the time I got here, and nothing looked wrong, so I figured it was just someone doing a three-point turn.
Milo said, "What kind of car?"
"That I can tell you," said Brassing. "Camaro, 80s, cool color, black. It makes them look more racy, you know?"
I said, "A week ago, so last Friday."
"That's when I do the Palmers, twice a month. They play golf, I go in and check around."
Milo said,
"Catch a look at who was driving?"
"Nope, it was going pretty fast."
Milo handed Brassing his card.
"You see it again. Try to get the license plate. Even if you don't, give me a ring, okay?"
"It's important?"
"Sure," said Brassing.
The three of us stood.
Brassing said, "One thing, sir. I'm not sure if I still have the job. Thought I'd give Mrs. Corvin some time to settle down before I ask her."
"My advice," said Milo, "is let it ride. You don't hear from her, you've got the job."
Brassing winked.
"Don't upset the apple cart, huh?"
"Exactly, Dave. When's your next visit scheduled?"
"Like in a couple of weeks."
"You can drive by, but don't go inside until I tell you it's okay."
"Why's that?"
"I need to keep the place as is."
"For CSI stuff?"
"That kind of thing."
"Got it."
Brassing read the card.
"Homicide. Can't believe that actually happened."
Chapter 26.
Milo and I stood outside as Brassing drove away in an old Ford van.
He said, "Braun bit Chet. Chet's girlfriend, and now the Camaro kid at Braun's house and here. So he's definitely involved, and there's definitely a link between Chet and Braun. The whole chocolate thing. I was starting to think the case was coming together, but it's feeling like a magician's gag. Poof, nothing materializes. Are you seeing something I'm not?"
I said, "Wish I was."
"Brutal honesty," he said. "So what now?"
I'd resume the surveillance on Bit and call Henry Prieto to let him know he was onto something with the Camaro. He still thinks of himself as a cop, Will Eagle Eye. Who handles law enforcement here?
San Bernardino, Sheriff, Twin Peaks Station.
Would they do a forensic workup of the house?
With no obvious crime? Hard to say.
Long as we're here, I said, we could check the places where Corvin spent money. Could give us something on the girlfriend.
He's got a love nest here. Why would he use a hotel in San Bernardino?
Moving around to be less conspicuous, creature comforts, or just plain novelty. The company was paying for everything, so why not take advantage? On the way, we can stop in Arrowhead Village and ask around. He shot a cuff and looked at his Timex.
It's pushing 4. We'll be coming back late.
Less traffic. He slapped my back.
Unbridled optimism. patent it and you'll own your own jet.
We sat in the Dodge and examined Chet Corvin's recent San Bernardino expenditures. 6 days in 3 hotels, all tagged as inns. 3 restaurant tabs at 2 Italian and 1 Mexican restaurant. Everything close to the freeway in the inland city's business core. A call to the Twin Peaks Sheriff Station produced bafflement when Milo admitted the house wasn't a likely crime scene. He got shunted up the brass rod, ended with a captain named Becerra, who resisted, but finally agreed to limited cooperation. Once permission to enter was granted in writing by the current owner and non-intrusive access could be guaranteed, the A-frame would eventually be processed for prints, fibers, and obvious body fluids. Meaning a visual inspection, but no dogs or alternative light source, unless something probative came up. Milo said, "Thanks," trying to mean it.
"I can get you a key for access, and there's also a caretaker. In terms of written consent, would a fax work?"
"Probably," said Becerra. "It's going to take time anyway. We're swamped with real stuff."
In Arrowhead Village, 40 or so trendy-leaning businesses were backdropped by the lake. Emphasis on clothing and personal appearance, beauty salons, a Pilates studio, a gym. We walked from store to store, showing pictures of Chet Corvin, Hal Braun, and Trevor Bitt, eliciting headshakes. Several merchants said, "Some of the weekenders never come in." The losing streak was broken at one of the last shops, Snowbird Jewelers. Just over a month ago, Chet Corvin had purchased a silver filigree necklace set with amethysts for $612.43, paying with cash. The proprietor, an older Iranian man in a white shirt and tie, remembered Corvin because he was very enthusiastic. Milo said,
"About what, sir?"
The man adjusted his eyeglasses.
"Buying it. Winking all the time."
He demonstrated, the result more comical than lascivious.
"Did he come in alone?"
"He did," said the man. "It was a surprise. You're saying not for the wife, eh?"
"I figured." "Why's that?"
"The winking. Wives get presents. They don't get winking."
We got back in the car and began the descent of Highway 18. Covering the shopping center had taken time, and the sky was fighting to stay lit, bashful lemon-colored sun hiding behind cotton-puff clouds. Below the firmament, the forest had turned black. As dusk set in, the road curves grew challenging. Milo took a turn without braking. The Dodge squealed in protest. He slowed down. 2 mile markers later, he said,
$600 necklace. So he was in love, or lust, or whatever guys like him are in. Let's check out the local hostelries.
Chapter 27. Nothing inn-like about the Hampton Inn by Hilton. Just a 4-story beige rectangle logoed in tomato red. The cheerful young woman at the desk lost her cheer when Milo showed her his badge along with Chet Corvin's photo. Samantha.
I don't think I can talk about guests.
This guest is deceased.
He'd gentled his tone. That made it sound worse, which was probably his intention. Samantha shrank back.
Dead?
Milo said,
murdered. So if you could help us, we'd really appreciate it.
Hold on.
Backing away, she opened a rear door and slipped through. Nothing happened for several minutes. The lobby was empty, no one checking in or out. Soft rock streamed from above. A grave-looking woman in her mid-30s emerged from the back.
How can I help you, officers?
Brianna. Milo repeated what he'd told Samantha.
She said, I'd have to check with legal affairs to verify that we can divulge that, and they're gone for the day.
Milo placed an arm on the counter and leaned in.
Appreciate your being careful, Brianna, but we're not asking for state secrets, just checking to see if anyone around here remembers Mr. Corvin.
She looked away, fiddled with her name tag.
Actually, I do. He's been here a few times.
3 times, between 5 and 8 weeks ago, said Milo. We have his credit card history.
Oh, said Brianna. Well, I can't tell you much more than that. I only remember him because he was kind of...
She sucked in breath.
I don't want to put anyone down. Certainly not a deceased person.
Of course not, Brianna. But this was a particularly nasty, cold-blooded murder, so anything you could tell us would be appreciated.
Her eyes flicked upward.
One of those times, I checked him in. It's not like I had a strong memory of it, but your picture reminded me.
He stood out.
Well, said Brianna, more like he was too friendly. I didn't do anything special for him, but he told me I was A1, said he'd ask for me personally from now on.
Flirtatious?
He didn't engage in inappropriate touch or use suggestive language and gestures.
Someone who'd attended the corporate seminar.
I said, but... He acted as if we already knew each other, and now that I think about it, I guess he did use a suggestive gesture. Winking.
Did you find him creepy?
Not really, more like annoying.
Too much of what my grandma calls being forward.
I feel kind of bad talking about him now that he's been...
Milo said, did he stay here alone?
It was a single occupancy reservation, all 3 times.
Her eyes shifted up again, then to the left. Milo said,
that's not exactly what I asked, Brianna.
I'm sorry, Lieutenant. I can't divulge those kinds of things.
Not even off the record?
I heard there really was no such thing in law enforcement.
From who?
My grandpa. He was a sheriff in Fontana.
Maybe in his day, said Milo. There sure is off the record now.
He crossed his heart.
I should probably ask Grandpa to make sure.
Sudden, icy smile.
Just kidding. I believe you. Okay, off the record.
She looked around.
The 3rd time he was here, he checked in alone also, but later that evening I did see him with someone, and they were pretty friendly. She went up in the elevator with him. I can't tell you if she stayed over. Not because I don't want to, because I don't know. But she definitely went up with him, and they were kind of affectionate.
She blushed. Nice to see that was still possible. I said, just that once.
I wasn't on night shift for the other 2, so I can't tell you what happened.
Milo said,
if you took a peek at the room service charges, maybe we could figure it out.
You said you had his credit charges.
They don't specify.
He opened his case, took out the records, showed her.
She said, oh, that makes sense. For guest privacy, we don't itemize. I'm sorry, I definitely can't show you our paperwork without authorization from legal.
Sly smile.
But I guess I could see for myself.
She smiled.
Grandpa would tell me to stop pussyfooting and help you out. He's always griping about the ACLU. Hold on.
The lobby door swung open with an assisted whoosh, admitting a Doppler wave of traffic noise and a harried-looking couple in their 50s. Both wore baggy T-shirts, shorts, white socks, and sneakers, pushed matching red roller bags toward the counter. When they were 10 feet away, the man announced,
checking in!
Brianna said, be right with you, sir,
and walked through the door that had taken Samantha. The woman said,
She disappears. That's some idea of service.
Samantha reappeared.
Hi. I can take care of you here.
She motioned the couple to the far end of the counter.
Not so bad,
muttered the man.
We'll see,
said the woman. The check-in process commenced. One credit card declined, then a second. Incredulous looks from the couple. Card three was the charm. Lots of face-covering scowls as they race-wheeled toward the elevators. Samantha typed on a computer, avoiding looking at us. Brianna returned and told her to go back in the office and check the monthlies. When the office door closed, she said,
Okay, what I can tell you is the second and third times your Mr. Corvin either had a huge appetite or someone was with him.
Two steaks, etc., said Milo.
Brianna recited from memory.
Dinner was one surf and turf, one chicken salad, two garden salads, two ice cream sundaes, a bottle of wine. Breakfast was two omelets, two orange juices, and toast for two. Plus, they used two vodka minis from the self-serve fridge.
Hearty breakfast plus screwdrivers, said Milo. Was the wine Chardonnay?
Her eyes rounded.
How did you know?
Lucky guess. So what did this woman look like?
Can't really say, sir. I barely had a look at her.
What do you remember?
Honestly, not much.
Age?
I guess like him, but I couldn't swear to it. Maybe a little younger.
Heavy, thin?
I'd have to say average.
Tall, short?
Brianna shook her head.
Nothing stood out. Probably average again. Sorry.
You're doing fine. What about hair color?
She smiled. That I can tell you. Dark and kind of longish. The truth is the two of them walked fast. Straight over there.
Eyeing the elevators.
I mostly saw the back of her.
Deeper blush.
His hand was on her tush.
Chummy, said Milo.
Pardon?
Friendly.
If that's what you call it, said Brianna. I just figured they were all heated up and raring to go.
She didn't remove his hand.
Oh, no, said Brianna. She kind of wiggled.
Her response to photos of Hal Braun and Trevor Bitt was quick and serene. The easy questions on the test. Never seen him. Not him either. Milo thanked her again. The anything else that sometimes provides pleasant surprises produced a headshake. As we walked away, she said,
Grandpa will be proud of me.
The Hilton Garden Inn wore the same beige and red livery as its cousin. Again, four stories, nothing inn-like or garden-like. Milo went through the same process with a cheerful young man named Cook, eager to tell us he'd been on the job 5 days. Enough time to know the drill, he punted to a supervisor, a woman who could have been Brianna's sister, Lara. Maybe there is a machine somewhere extruding staff for the corporate Hydra. Lara had no memory of Chet Corvin, but she was more forthcoming than Brianna, checking her records without prodding and confirming that room service charges from 6 weeks ago.
Sure looks like two people, but I can't tell you who he was with.
No recognition of Braun or Bitt. She returned to her office. Cook fist-bumped air as we left.
Good luck, guys!
When we were out of earshot, Milo said,
Name like that. Kid should work in the kitchen.
Stop three was a Residence Inn Marriott, where Corvin had checked in just over a month ago. Beige stucco and a huge creative leap to white lettering. Except for the corporate logo in, big shock, red. More pleasant young people, but had now become a routine of refusal, cadging, followed by a trickle of information. Dinner for two, no specific memory of Corvin, blank stares in response to bits and bronze photos. That left the restaurants. Chapter 28 Papa Giorgio was closed for renovation and had been since 2 days after Chet Corvin had charged dinner. San Remo and Mexicali Cafe were bustling, throngs of hungry weekend diners crowding the host stations. The people behind the stations looked harried and distracted and pretended not to notice us. Milo made his way past the crowd, stepped in close to each of them, and announced,
"This is about a homicide,"
loud enough to be heard over the din. A few people near him recoiled. Wilson R. at San Remo said,
"Oh, man, just hold on for a sec."
Lourdes Briceno at Mexicali said,
"Oh, my God, sure, sure, please, just wait."
Two quick shuffles through computers produced Chet Corvin's receipts at both restaurants. Dinner for two. The unifying factor, red meat. At San Remo, spaghetti bolognese and fettuccine with beef cheeks. The Combo Grande at Mexicali, a masterpiece for two built around carne asada. Two bottles of high-priced Chardonnay. Corvin's quirky taste in wine or pleasing his companion? Milo asked each of the hosts if they could recall the couple who'd eaten those meals. Wilson R. said,
"Not unless they're regulars,"
examining the receipt.
"Nope."
To the queue,
"Bainbridge, party of four."
Lourdes Briceno said,
"I really wish I could help you guys, but I really don't remember. Really, so sorry."
She walked away with the next lucky eaters. The Mexican place was our last stop. We'd arrived just after 8 p.m., had been kept waiting as the population of salivating citizens swelled. Lots of families, lots of kids. Milo said,
"Post-hunger baby boom!"
Cupping his mouth to be heard above human chatter, flatware clatter, and piped in mariachi music. Lourdes Briceno returned, looking surprised to see us. Milo said,
"You didn't hear my last question. Do you remember the party?"
"Oh, no, I don't. Really sorry."
"No prob."
He loomed a bit, gave the wolf grin.
"Been a long day. Any way you could squeeze us in for dinner?"
She looked past us.
"Sure, of course. We really appreciate what you do."
Picking up two menus, she guided us toward the rear of the restaurant, raising grumbles. Milo mumbled,
"Bring on the pitchforks and the lanterns."
Lourdes Briceno, sounding utterly unconvincing, called out,
"One second, people. They have a reservation."
She hurried us to a table set into a corner, more of a drink stand. Barely wide enough for two people if elbows were kept at bay. I thought, just like his office. Milo rolled his shoulders and slid in. Lourdes Briceno said,
"I know he's really cramped, but it's really the best I can do. Really sorry."
When she left, Milo said,
"I really believe her."
He studied his menu like a monk assigned to an illuminated manuscript.
"Everything sounds pretty good. Place smells good. Finally something to block out that damn perfume."
He began to lay the menu down. That would have covered his half of the table, so he held on to it.
"The combo, what Chet ordered, actually sounds pretty good."
"It's for two."
"You're back to being ascetic?"
"Go for it."
"Great," he said. "Once I get my share down here..."
Patting his gut.
"Maybe I'll have one of those New Age mystical experiences."
I said, "Cow-induced insight?"
"Ingest what the victim did and stimulate empathy."
"Better than ingesting the victim." He laughed. Lourdes Briceno returned with a handheld device.
"We're really jammed, so I'm taking care of you guys.
Do you know what you want?
Milo gave her the order. She said,
Great choice. It's really popular. To drink?
The heart says cerveza. The job says iced tea.
She pouted.
Oh, poor guys. Okay, some chips and salsa will be coming up in a sec.
She bounced away. No mention that we'd ordered the same thing as Corvin. She probably hadn't noticed. That's the way it is with most people. Details are an intrusion. Then there's the rest of us, lying in bed at 3 a.m., scrolling through volumes of mental small print. I said, Cow and Chardonnay. Milo nodded.
Don't tell the gender police, but I'm thinking lady's choice. That, the necklace, whoever she is, they had more going on than porn in a motel. And the fact they've been together 2 months points against a hit woman. So, the question is, what happened to her at the Sahara? And if she escaped and cared about Chet, why not come forward?
Fear, I said. That fits with her being the one who called it in, avoiding 911 to stay anonymous and keep her voice unrecorded. A busboy brought a mini trough of corn chips, a soup bowl full of salsa, beer steins filled with frosty tea. Using a comically dainty finger grasp, Milo extracted a chip, dipped, tasted, sipped, repeated, and let out a contented sigh.
Quality, but not at the expense of quantity. The key to success in the home of the brave.
A dozen pulverized chips later,
Chet and Madame X tryst up at the lake and down here in the city. Maybe she's someone local. Now, what about the Camaro?
I said, Ventura to Arrowhead covers a lot of ground. Strong emotion can do that.
Hatred as jet fuel of the soul. Didn't some psychologist say that?
Never heard it. He grinned.
That's 'cause I just made it up. Yeah, you're making sense. The hippie had some kind of beef with Braun and Corvin. His age, that could slam us back to what you said before. Chelsea's forbidden boyfriend. He stalked both his victims, took care of Braun first, spotted Chet driving here, and then back to Hollywood.
I said, maybe MJ Braun's remembered something since we spoke to her. He phoned wife number 3. She continued to know no one with a black Camaro. Milo listened for a while, said,
Not to my knowledge. No, honestly, ma'am, we're just asking questions.
Exactly.
Okay, I will. I'll definitely put in the request. Take care.
He hung up.
She'll be looking at cars on her block all the time now and freaking out. On top of that, she's having a painful arthritis attack. I'm definitely meant to feel guilty.
He demolished a few more chips.
My atonement is I call Ventura PD, ask for some drive-bys at her place.
He followed through, got referred up the chain per usual, ended up with a tepid, we'll see, from someone of his own rank. He said,
Long as we're in the Ventura groove,
and called Henry Prieto. This time he hung up laughing.
He's already got his eyes peeled. Don't I think he'd let me know if he knew something?
Twin mountains of marinated beef, each ringed with slices of avocado and radishes, arrived. Side bowls of refried beans, rice, and pozole stew, supplemented by a coarse blackstone bowl of guacamole and a platter of glazed pepper-rubbed pork ribs.
Whoa,
said Milo.
She says mucho gusto,
said the server, pointing to Lourdes Briceño, holding an armful of menus as she shepherded a party of 8 across the room. Grumpy octet, the squinty-eyed look of plane wreck survivors assessing their friend's nutritional value. Milo waved at her. She returned the gesture wearily.
At least someone likes me,
he said.
Too bad she's really irrelevant.
I was hungry and adrenalized, put away more food than usual before hitting the satiation wall. I pushed my plate away. Milo's attention was fixed on his own dinner, his arms food-ingesting turbines. I was drinking tea when he came up for air. A glance at my partially eaten Alp.
She probably did that. Ms. Armani.
Did what?
Sat there like you, self-righteous and slim, while old Chet packed it away.
I said, you engaging in culinary snobbery?
Just pointing out the sin of moderation. It's a cross I bear. Not just you, Rick, the rest of the unreasonably reasonable world.
He hunched over his food and got back on task. Another avocado heard from. His remark made me think about Chet Corvin and his mistress rendezvousing, dining, partying at several locations. That sparked another thought. I said, this is far-fetched, but what if Donna Wayland, the woman who just left her husband, is a brunette around Chet's age or younger? He put his utensils down.
What brought that on?
Mental meandering. I thought of that scene we saw a few nights ago, Paul Wayland driving up all hangdog, telling Felice his marriage was over. In all this time, we've never seen Donna. A new relationship would explain that. And where do people find lovers? At work and close to home.
The old neighbor game, he said.
His eyes sparked.
Hey, Felice was pretty touchy-feely with Wayland. Otherwise, she's been an ice queen. What if the infidelity cut both ways?
Chet and Donna, Felice and Paul.
Sounds like a movie, but why not? The basic steamy suburbia. Hell, the whole goddamn cul-de-sac could be a nest of sin. Bit and Chelsea on one side, marital messes on the other.
He frowned.
Be great for prime time, but how does Black Camaro fit in? Not to mention brawn. Hell, there's one thing I can do.
He phone-googled an image search, handed me the cell. 5 Donna Waylands, 3 of them in their 20s. A gorgeous black cheerleader at the University of Houston was caught in midair. An Alaska Air flight attendant from Vancouver, British Columbia, posed in a bikini on an unnamed beach. A game show developer from Williamsburg, Brooklyn, sported more iron in her face than a high-power magnet. Donna Ethelina Wayland of Paterson, New Jersey, had passed away in 1937. Donna A. Wayland, an employee of the L.A. Unified School District, appeared once in a group shot of an educational task force convening in Reno. Middle-aged, full-faced and zoftic, hair that could be gray or blonde, clipped in a no-nonsense page, oversized glasses, a hesitant smile. Milo said,
she might have broken Paul's heart, but I'm not getting Armani, pricey chocolates and vino from someone like Chet.
I handed the phone back. He swabbed at his mouth with a napkin, motioned the busboy over, and ordered coffee. Milo drank 2 cupfuls, pried his bulk upward, and tossed cash on the table. No need to wait for the check. He always surpasses. I said, let's split it.
Like that's gonna happen.
Scooping more chips out of the bowl, he tilted his head toward the front door.
Pitchforks are gone. Let's head back to alleged civilization.
Chapter 29. Not a word from Milo the following day. Nothing on my Saturday calendar other than dinner with Robin. Meanwhile, she was working. I drove to the Palisades, parked a quarter mile from the Corvins, and walked. Using your legs in L.A. when you're not accompanied by a dog makes people nervous. When I was a block away, I clipped my expired LAPD consultant badge to my belt. It entitles me to nothing but can mute anxiety. At the mouth of Evada Lane, that was put to the test. As I entered the cul-de-sac, an older, pale blue BMW 6 drove past me, stopped for a moment, then rolled up the driveway of the second house on the north side of the